Okay, so welcome everyone to the last quantum gravity seminar of the year. Today we have Javier Relancho from the University of Saragossa, and he's going to tell us about quantum space-time, the form of relativistic kinematics. And I'd let Javier take it away.
Thanks for letting me give a seminar here. I start. Do I start or I wait?
Yeah, you can go on. Yeah.
I would like to warn that many references are missing in the slides of my talk. For details, please look at the literature cited in the referenced paper. So let us start with the talk. One of the challenges of theoretical physics nowadays is the unification of general relativity and quantum field theory, or equivalently, the formulation of a quantum gravity theory. Both theories were checked experimentally in the past century. Present fundamental incompatibilities which have their origin in the role that space-time plays in them. It is a dynamical variable in general relativity and a static frame in quantum field theory. This leads theoretical physicists to think that maybe special relativity should be modified at high energies, appearing a completely new framework in which basic concepts considered as fundamental should be changed, like the notion of a continuous space-time or locality of interactions. As we will see, a way to try to capture residual effects of our quantum gravity theory is by considering the formation of the special relativistic kinematics. These ingredients appear in the so-called double special relativity theories, or DSR. In many works in the literature, a connection between our relativistic deformed kinematics and a curved momentum space has been explored. We will see that considering a maximally symmetric momentum space, one can construct a relativistic deformed kinematics, and that the Kappa-Poincaré model is obtained as a particular case when the curvature of the space is positive. One of the much-studied phenomenological consequences of DSR is a time delay for photons. However, DSR is formulated in a flat space-time, which is not the correct way to consider the propagation of a photon in an expanding universe. So we will study the generalization of the gravitational approach for a curved space-time. We will develop the construction of a metric in the phase space that takes into account the relativistic deformed kinematics in the presence of a non-trivial geometry in space-time. With generalization of the usual procedure of general relativity, we will study the phenomenological consequences of a momentum-dependent metric in the phase space for astrophysics and cosmology. Also, there is an open question in the literature regarding momentum coordinates represent different physics. In order to explore this question in our framework, we will see that one can construct the Einstein equations and that requiring that the Einstein tensor is conserved, one finds a privileged momentum basis. We will explore some features of these particular momentum coordinates. And finally, we will see the conclusions and future prospects, exposing the main results exposed in this talk. So let us start with the introduction. In the history of physics, the exploration of a smaller case has required new theoretical frameworks. As a Russian doll, reality has revealed time after time cells of a smaller scale. This leads us to the question, could we continue exploring closer the structure of nature, finding more and more cells? Is there a limit we cannot go beyond? If this limit exists, is it based on theoretical arguments or is it due to experimental reasons? Any answer has to include not only the structure of matter, it has also to include the structure of space-time, so it has to include gravity. If fundamental constituents of matter exist, does the same happen for space-time? Do space atoms exist? One has also to take into account that to measure smaller distances requires concentrating high energies in small volumes, so one cannot neglect the space-time curvature. In fact, there is a limit in this amount of energy that we can concentrate due to the possible collapse into a black hole, so the gravitational interaction is indispensable. One of the challenges for theoretical physics in our days is the unification of general relativity and quantum field theory. These two theories disagree in the role that space-time plays in them. In quantum field theory, one assumes a given spacetime and one studies with detail the properties and the movement of particles in it. On the other hand, in general relativity, one assumes that the properties of matter and radiation are given, and one describes with detail the resultant spacetime, that is, one studies the curvature. But in general relativity, the spacetime is classic, non-quantum, is a classical theory, while quantum field theory is a quantum theory. Also, one could try to develop a quantum gravity theory considering an interaction mediated by a spin-2 particle, the graviton, that leads to the same equations that appear in general relativity. The main problem of this theory is that it's not renormalizable, losing its predictability for energies comparable with the Planck scale. Then one could wonder, if we have a theory for massive objects, general relativity, and another one for lighter particles, quantum field theory, what do we need a quantum gravity theory for? If one wants to describe the first instant of the universe, one needs a theory that describes small particles with enormous energies. Also, we don't know what happens inside a black hole. What happens with information once it crosses the event horizon? What happens when one comes to the singularity? To answer all these questions, we need a quantum gravity theory. There have been a lot of attempts to avoid the problems of inconsistency between general relativity and quantum field theory, string theory, quantum gravity, supergravity, causality theory. In most of these theories, a minimum length appears, normally associated to the Planck length, and therefore there is an energy scale, the Planck one. The main problem is that there are no experimental observations that may help us to decide which is the correct approach to a fundamental theory of quantum gravity. We know that the spacetime in a quantum gravity theory should change its classical nature, leading to a quantum structure, and precisely a way to characterize it will be to consider a minimum length, in such a way that at small distances, spacetime doesn't take a well-defined shape. Also, we can wonder about the symmetries of this theory. Although we do not know them, we do know that Lorentz invariants should be broken of the form and these scales. Due to these quantum fluctuations of spacetime, new effects unthinkable in a classical spacetime could be introduced, such as the possible creation of micro black holes. Then one could regard this spacetime as a form in which particles move. So spacetime could be as in this image. This form could lead to additional effects that do not appear in the classical spacetime. Could the movement of particles be modified? Could an energy-dependent velocity for massless particles, or even a different dispersion relation for each type of particle appear? Could a non-locality of interaction arise? One can obtain the Planck length, time, and mass through the fundamental constants of gravitation, relativity, and quantum theories. Instead of considering a fundamental quantum gravity theory, we can start by a completely different approach, considering a low energy limit of such a theory. As we will see, this could have some experimental evidences. In these frameworks, one usually considers the limit in which the quantum and gravitation constants goes to zero, neglecting these effects, but the Planck mass is non-zero, what could lead to some possible experimental consequences, the so-called quantum gravity phenomenology. Following this idea, we can consider two ways to go beyond special relativity. As we have said, the usual symmetries at small scales could be broken, and this is what happens in Lorentz invariant violation theories. This possibility was started to be considered during the 60s. In this theory, the Lorentz symmetry is a valid symmetry for low energies, being broken for energies comparable with the Planck scale. This implies that there is a loss of the relativity principle that characterizes special relativity, giving place to a privileged observer. Therefore, the laws describing physics depends on the observer. A conservative way to consider this theory is supposing a field theory. Then, new Lorentz invariant violations terms are added to the standard model, leading to an effective field theory known as standard model extension. With consideration, in particular, terms that violate Lorentz invariants are added to the standard model Lagrangian, with consideration of renormalizability, gauge symmetry, or field content. However, instead of considering that Lorentz invariance is broken for high energies, one could consider that this symmetry is deformed. This is what is regarded in doubly special relativity. In this theory, there is a relativity principle. In particular, Einstein relativity principle is generalized by adding a new relativistic invariant to the speed of light, the Planck length. In this seminar, we will focus on doubly special relativity theories. After this introduction, we now focus on the ingredients of the kinematics in doubly special relativity theories. First of all, let us see what we understand by kinematics. In order to describe a process, we consider that particles participating in the process propagate freely without changing their momenta from the past infinity, interact between them, and the resultant particles propagate freely to the future infinity. The free propagation of incident and resulting particles is depicted by the dispersion relation that establishes a relationship between the energy, momentum, and the mass of the particle. However, the interaction is defined by the conservation of energy and momentum. Then the ingredients of the kinematics are a dispersion relation and a conservation law. For the kinematics of special relativity, the dispersion relation is a quadratic expression between the momentum and the mass of the particle. And there is a conservation law for the total momentum, defined as the sum of the momenta of the particles before and after the interaction. For the Lorentz invariant violation case, the dispersion relation is modified with respect to the one of special relativity, considering normally a power series expansion where lambda plays the role of the high energy scale. We see that when lambda tends to infinity, one recovers the usual dispersion relation of special relativity. In the Lorentz invariant violation case, the composition of the momenta, given the conservation law, is still the same. So let us see what happens in doubly special relativity case. In this framework, a relativistic deformed kinematics appears, containing a deformed dispersion relation, a conservation law, defined from a deformed composition of momenta, that what we would call a deformed composition law, and deformed Lorentz transformations, making the two previous ingredients compatible with the relativity principle. Note that one of the main ingredients between this and the main difference, sorry, between this and the previous approach is the deformed conservation law for the momenta, which is a fundamental ingredient if one wants to keep a relativity principle. Also, one can make a change of variables reducing the dispersion relation to the one of special relativity. There is a crucial ingredient that can never be simplified, this deformed composition law. This is then the fundamental ingredient of doubly special relativity theories. The construction of a deformed kinematics in doubly special relativity is usually formulated with a mathematical tool of Hopf algebras. The most studied model obtained in Hopf algebras is known as Kappa Poincaré. In the so-called Bicross product basis, the deformed dispersion relation is this one, and the composition law for the momenta is no longer the sum, and takes this expression. Note that this composition law is not symmetric, but one can check that it is associative. This is a very particular case of a relativistic deformed kinematics. Although this composition law may seem strange, let us think for a moment in the velocity sum of special relativity. In order to be the speed of light the same for all observers, there is a velocity sum for different from the ordinary Galilean sum. In doubly special relativity, besides the speed of light, we want a high energy scale to be invariant. So it is not weird that the formation of the momentum of the sum of momenta appears, even invariant these two scales. Now we can wonder, could a relativistic deformed kinematics have a geometrical interpretation? Remember that the gravitational interaction can be described through a space-time curvature. So just like the passage from special relativity to general relativity is consists of considering a curved space-time instead of a flat one, could be the passage from special relativity to doubly special relativity be depicted by a curved momentum space? In this section, we will answer this question in an assertive way. The idea of a quantum gravity of a curved momentum space was introduced by Bohr in the 30s. He considered a duality between space-time and momentum variables in such a way that if normally one can consider a non-trivial geometry in space-time, there could be a non-trivial geometry in momentum space. This proposal was introduced as a way to avoid the ultraviolet divergences in quantum field theory. And some years ago was considered again as a possible way to go beyond special relativity. However, the main problem that arises in the world studying this approach is that there is not a clear way to implement the relativity principle. that is to relate the deformed composition law with the deformed dispersion relation in the right way. In our scheme, we consider the dispersion relation as the square of the distance from the origin to a point k in momentum space. This was previously considered in the literature. The reason is that the distance is defined as an invariant under change of coordinates in a geometry, and the dispersion relation has to be also invariant under transformations between reference systems if there is a relativity principle. Both the composition law and the law of generators will be the isometries of the metric, and their generators from a Lie algebra. Since we are considering a momentum space of four dimensions, we want four translations and six Lorentz generators. So we need the momentum space to have 10 isometries in order to define a relativistic kinematics. The only spaces with such property are the maximally symmetric spaces, Minkowski, de Sitter, and anti-de Sitter. So let us see again the kinematics of special relativity from our geometric perspective. The special relativity momentum space will be the flat one. The dispersion relation will be the square of the distance from the origin to k, which is the square of the four momentum. And the conservation law corresponds to the four isometries related to translations, that is, an abelian subgroup inside the isometries group. And finally, the Lorentz transform generators are related with the six isometries of the Lorentz group. Now we see that this scheme is compatible with the kinematics of special relativity. One can wonder what happens for a curved momentum space in the de Sitter case. We have found a systematic way to obtain the deformed kinematics from a metric, and more precisely from a tetrad in momentum space. One can find the Lorentz transformation through this equation, and we find translations asking them to leave invariant the form of the tetrad. This is a particular kind of isometries, since if they leave invariant the form of the tetrad, the metric will be also invariant. And by construction, they form a subgroup inside the group of the isometries. Summarizing, starting from a metric, we define all the ingredients of our relativistic deformed kinematics. But the equation relating the tetrad with the composition law is not satisfied by every tetrad. A result of differential geometry says that the directional derivatives of the tetrad must close an algebra in order to be able to find a composition law. Specifically, we see that for this particular choice of the Sitter tetrad, the directional derivatives of the tetrad close an algebra, which is Kappa Minkowski, and we also find the same kinematics of Kappa Poincaré in the bicross product basis. We see that we have understood the kinematics of double special relativity through a curved momentum space. We have been able to find a deformed kinematics without using a complicated algebraic scheme, just using the geometrical properties of a curved momentum space. Following a similar approach, one can find other kinematics, those that do not have an associative composition law, that appear in the literature. Now we can wonder about the generalization of this geometrical approach for a curved spacetime. This is motivated by the study of time delays, since the photon propagates in an expanding universe. Moreover, this is the next logical step from the geometrical approach. Since the gravitational interaction can be described by a curved spacetime, and we have seen that the passage from special relativity to double special relativity is depicted by a curved momentum space, can we combine both curvatures in order to deform general relativity? We need to construct a metric depending on the momentum variables and on the spacetime coordinates. That is, a metric with a curvature on both momentum space and spacetime. But in order to study the properties of this kind of metric, we need to know how to deal with a cotangent bundle geometry. We start by considering the cotangent bundle of general relativity, so we can get familiarized with the basic notions of this kind of geometries. We know that the trajectories of particles in general relativity are described by the geodesic equation obtained from the metric. Furthermore, the same trajectories can be obtained from the Hamilton equations with this casing. From the equation of motion, one can regard the momentum as a function of the metric and the velocity. This means that for a curved spacetime, the momentum changes along geodesics. Therefore, the geodesics can be regarded as a particular trajectory in phase space, where the motion in spacetime is given by the geodesic equation and the motion in momentum depicted by the affine connection. This result comes from a straightforward derivation of the equation of motion. Also, this combination of coefficients multiplying the velocity are usually known as the nonlinear connection. For a momentum-dependent metric, this relationship between the affine connection and the nonlinear coefficient doesn't need to hold. We can visualize this in the cotangent bundle. We start by considering a base manifold M with four dimensions and the curve spacetime in which particles move. From this manifold, one can construct the cotangent bundle manifold T star M, which has dimension 8. This manifold is formed by the base manifold, the spacetime, and the fibers, the momentum space, denoted by B, which is usually called the vertical distribution. Then this structure gives the geometry for all the phase space variables. We can now continue the previous discussion of general relativity. The geodesic motion in the cotangent bundle is depicted by these delta derivatives, which takes into account that along a geodesic, there is a movement not only in the base manifold, the spacetime, but along the fiber in momentum space. And then this is the expression for the delta derivatives. As expected, they depend on the nonlinear coefficient describing the variation of the momentum along a geodesic. For a generic metric, this connection can be obtained in an unequivocal way when imposing symmetry in its two indices and compatibility of the affine connection with the metric. Now, instead of having a singular line element in spacetime, we have a line element for the whole phase space, where this delta key is depends also on the nonlinear coefficients. We can see that there are two preferred types of curves. One for which delta k is zero, leading to the spacetime geodesics, and another one for which dx is zero, giving the movement along the fiber. Then the horizontal curves lead to the geodesic motion in spacetime, where h is the affine connection of the spacetime, and the change of momentum is obtained from this expression, imposing that this delta k is zero. We can now consider the vertical paths, which are curves in the cotangent bundle with constant space-time coordinate, and with the momentum satisfying a geodesic equation C, with a geodesic equation with C, the connection of the momentum space. In this paper, we saw that there is a clear correspondence between the equation of motion obtained from a Hamiltonian and the trajectory of particles given by a geodesic equation. Moreover, it is easy to see that the distance in momentum space is conserved along a horizontal path. Then one can consider a function of such distance as the Casimir. Now we can wonder which function of the distance must be regarded as the Casimir in order to have the same trajectories from Hamilton equation and geodesic motion of a metric in phase space. In order to have a smooth limit to GR, the Casimir must be the square of the distance. Okay, until now we know how to consider a metric in the momentum space leading to a deformed relativistic kinematics, but we don't know how to construct a metric in the cotangent bundle that includes a curvature in spacetime. For that aim, we start by observing that there is a simple way to relate the distance between the origin and a point key, okay, and the metric in momentum space. Then, regarding the Casimir as the square of the distance in momentum space, one easily finds this equation. In GR, one can consider a spacetime curvature just by replacing the momenta by the momenta times the inverse of the tetrad of the spacetime metric, which we call the bar momentum variables. Then, the previous equation is generalized to this equation. Therefore, the new Casimir can be regarded as the square of the distance along the fiber for a fixed space-time point. thanks to this expression, we can define a new metric for the canonical variables as a function of the tetrad in spacetime and the tetrad in momentum space. This step can be done since we have taken into account that the momentum distance is computed along a fiber, that is, the Casimir is viewed as the square at the squared distance for a fixed spacetime point. Now we can see some properties of this metric. One can check that this metric is invariant under spacetime diffeomorphism. Moreover, it is easy to see that if the original momentum metric has a constant scalar of curvature in momentum space, also the new metric satisfies this property. In this case, we can define the isometries of the momentum metric for a fixed spacetime point. We have found the modified translations and the modified Lorentz transformation that leave invariant this modified dispersion relation. Now we have understood how to deal with a metric depending on all the phase space variables, we can study some phenomenological implication of our proposal. First of all, we can wonder if the Planck energy is 10 to the 19 GeV and particle accelerators have an energy of 1.3 times 10 to the 4 GeV, and particles with coming from cosmic rays have an energy of 10 to the 11 GeV, how we can talk about phenomenology? The answer is that phenomenological windows are a consequence of applications at low energy. But before going on, let us explain some differences between the phenomenology of Lorentz invariance and violation and W special relativity. In Lorentz invariance violation, there are several papers in the literature showing possible experimental consequences despite having such a huge difference between scales. For example, a radiation forbidden in special relativity could be allowed for a certain energy in this context. Also, Lorentz invariance violation, Lorentz invariance violation kinematics change the threshold energy of allowed processes of special relativity. This kind of experiments allow us to constrain the high energy scale. However, due to the relativity principle present in W special relativity, all the reactions forbidden in special relativity are also forbidden in this framework, and the modification of the threshold are negligible when considering that the high energy scale is of the order of the Planck energy. Then, when considering the deformation scale of the order of the Planck energy, the only phenomenological window in W special relativity is a possible time delay of flight of massless particles. If there is an energy-dependent velocity for massless particles, we could observe that photons with different energies coming from the same astrophysical source can arrive at different times due to the fact that this small correction is amplified by the long-distance ray travel. Now we can try to see what are the predictions for this possible effect from our model. We start by considering the de Sitter momentum metric used previously, and this leads to this line element on spacetime. So let us suppose a source at a distance r from our laboratory emitting light at different frequencies. For a low energy photon, we can neglect the momentum factor. So r is equal to x low, where x low is the space coordinate for a low energy photon. However, this is not the case for a high energy photon. From this line element, we can see r as the real distance between the source and us, making that the distance measured by the high energy photon is a product of the space coordinates times this momentum factor. This implies that in our scheme, there is no time delay of photons, which is in agreement with the actual experimental data. We are able, thanks to our geometrical formalism, to describe synchrotron radiation in DSR for the first time. In particular, we obtain for this de Sitter metric, which leads to a superluminal velocity for electrons, a critical frequency. Note that both signs on the momentum factor represents a maximally symmetric momentum space. One leads to a superluminal velocity for massive particles, and the other one to a subluminal velocity. So we can see that there is a maximum frequency allowing us to cast a constraint from the Crab nebula data on the high energy scale of thousands of TeV. this is the stronger constraint to this model for flat spacetime, since, as we saw, there is no time delay for massless particles. Now we can apply our formalism to the case of an universe expanding using the following metric, which is constructed with the tetrad of spacetime and the tetrad of the momentum space in the way we saw previously. A similar argument we used for the flat case leads to the same result of absence of time delay for massless particle. One can obtain here the modification on the redshift from which one can obtain a constraint of 49 keV on the high energy scale when comparing experimental data obtained from the visible and X-ray spectra of several active galactic nuclei, that is, from light with different energies. Also, we obtained that the luminosity distance from the gravitational wave and the gamma rays from a binary neutron star merger are different in this scheme, allowing us to cast a constraint of 8 keV. Then, when using cosmological data in order to constrain the high energy scale, we find that momentum-dependent redshift and luminosity distance lead to a very weak bounds on the scale, being of the order of some tens of keV. This shows that from cosmological phenomenology, we are not able to cast strong constraints on the high energy scale, deforming the usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. Also, we have considered a modification of the Schwarzschild black hole. In this case, we find that particles with different energies see the same horizon, in contrast with the Lorentz violating case. This is in agreement with the fact that in W-special relativity theories, there is a relativity principle. Moreover, we have computed the surface gravity, finding an energy dependence. This points to the possibility that the Hawking temperature could generally depend on the energy of the outgoing particles. In the previous computation, we have used a particular choice of coordinates of a de Sitter momentum metric in which the momentum correction of the Minkowski metrics start at first order in the inverse of the high energy scale. If we had used another coordinates in which, for example, the momentum deviation of the flat metric started at second order, we would have generally obtained different weaker constraints. This is related to the fact that different bases could represent different physics, which was considered deeply in the literature. While from both geometric and algebraical point of view, different choices of the kinematics of Poincaré, that is, different choices of coordinates of a de Sitter momentum space or different bases in Hopf algebra represent the same deform kinematics with the same properties, such as the associativity of the composition law and the relativity principle, there is an ambiguity about what are the momentum variables associated to physical measurements. The momenta we measure may change as well depending on the momentum variables. How we should identify momenta with our measurements, and if there is a physical choice of momentum variables, is still an open question. In this geometrical framework, we propose a way to select these physical bases from Einstein equations. The first step is to compute the Riemann tensor for a geometry in the cotangent bundle. This can be done from the geodesic deviation and from the commutator of two covariant derivatives, obtaining the same result. This tensor has the same form of GR, but replacing the usual space-time derivatives by this delta one, which depends also on the momentum. As done in this book, it is easy to construct the Einstein tensor. Following the physical idea that the momentum dependence of the metric is some sort of mesoscopy regime which should smoothly recover a Riemannian geometry at low energies, it is natural to impose that the Einstein equations continue to hold. The Einstein tensor must be conserved since we want that the energy momentum tensor has also this property. As we mentioned previously, the metric and all the tensors in general are invariant under space-time diffeomorphism, but they are not invariant under momentum change of coordinates. Then the conservation of the Einstein tensor selects one and only one momentum basis, that is, one coordinate in momentum space representing a de Sitter space. In particular, we obtain this momentum metric representing a Desiter momentum space, and the Casimir, that is the square of the distance of this metric, is this function, which is a function of the square of the momentum. This metric has a really important feature. It is easy to see that for this basis, the space-time affine connection, and then for the Ricci tensor, are momentum independent. Moreover, Einstein tensor is also momentum independent as a consequence of the conformally flat form of the momentum metric. Furthermore, this means that the vacuum solution of GR can be easily generalized in our scheme. We can now see what are the new Friedmann equations in this formalism. Since the Einstein tensor doesn't depend on the momentum, we can consider the usual energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid as in GR. Then one trivially finds the same Friedmann equations of GR, and one finds that the conservation of the energy momentum tensor is consistent with the Friedmann equations. Moreover, in this scheme, we found the modified Rajoudry equations. It is well known in GR that one can obtain the second Friedmann equation from the Rajoudry equation. We saw that the same happens in this context, having then a consistency check for our framework and how we constructed the Einstein tensor. Finally, let us summarize the main result of this talk. We have developed a geometrical interpretation of deformed relativistic kinematics. Through geometry, we have found a way to associate a composition law and a dispersion relation compatible with the relativity principle. Translations in momentum space define the composition law. Lorentz isometries, the Lorentz transformation of one particle, and a combination of both kinds of isometries leads to the Lorentz transformation in the two-particle system. This leads to a completely new understanding of the kinematics and how to implement the relativity principle from the geometrical approach. In particular, we have seen that the example of Kappa Poincaré the Pikos-Podov basis is a particular case of a deformed kinematics that can be obtained through this geometrical interpretation when the curved momentum space is the Sitter. This work can be generalized for other kinematics and for the case of anti-de Sitter. We have found a simple way to include a curvature in space-time in a curved momentum space, defining a metric for the whole phase space. We saw that one obtains the same trajectories from the Hamilton equations and from the geodesics of the metric. Moreover, it is easy to see that the distance in momentum space is conserved along a horizontal path. Then one can consider a function of such distance as the Casimir. Regarding the phenomenology of our model, we were able to describe for the very first time the synchrotron radiation in the SR scenario. We saw that the Crab Nebula data allows us to cast a constraint of the order of the PEV. However, from an universe expanding, we have found that taking into account that the physical distance traveled by particle depends on the momentum, there is no time delay for photons. Moreover, the luminosity distance and resit leads to a very weak constraints due to the fact that the precision rather than energies needed and the observational constraints are extremely high. For the sparsity black hole, we have seen that there is a common even horizon for all particles, in contrast with the result of a Lorentz violating scenario, where particles with different energies will see different horizons. This is in agreement with the relativity principle imposed in W-space relativity theories. However, the surface gravity is energy dependent, which seems to indicate that the Hawking temperature could also show such behavior. In this sense, one should not view the here presented result as discouraging from the phenomenological point of view. Indeed, one could take the alternative point of view that the here presented geometrical approach to DSR avoids the strong constraint currently disfavoring competing approach, and then open up the possibility that the high energy scale parametrizing deviation from spatial relativity could be much smaller than the Planck energy. From the conservation of the Einstein tensor, we were able to select one privileged momentum basis. This basis has the following properties. The Einstein tensor is momentum independent. The solutions of the Friedman equations for an expanding universe are compatible with the Rayleigh equation, which is a consistency check of how we constructed the Einstein equation in our framework. And finally, I saw the outlook and future prospect. We have seen several constraints of our model regarding astrophysics and cosmology. We hope to investigate other possible effects that cast stronger constraints on the high energy scale. We hope also to research in more detail formal aspects that could guide us to consistency checks of our proposal. Also, there are several papers in the literature studying time delays from an interaction model. In order to consider such analysis, we should have a description of a multiparticle system in our geometrical approach. This could allow us to determine if there is or not a time delay of massless particles, considering that emission and detection are depicted by interactions. And finally, we could try to give the first steps in a dynamical framework in Dark Space Relativity from our geometrical approach. And that's all. Thanks for your attention.
All right. Thanks, Javier, very much. So we can start with the questions. I see Bianca has her hand raised. Let's see, maybe there are questions from postdocs or students first. Well, if not, then Bianca, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks for this interesting talk. I have a couple of questions. One is that you started with introducing these R as the limit where G and H bar goes to zero, but the quotient does not. But then you introduce curvature and curve manifolds, which is interesting, but in particular for black holes, you know, I don't think that G goes to zero. So can you comment on that? What the philosophy here is?
Yeah, this is a tricky point in the sense that, we know DSR is constructed with the premise that, as you said, H bar and G goes to zero, but that the Planck scale doesn't go to zero. So one could think that maybe this scale, this high energy scale, doesn't need to be the Planck scale, and then it's just a deformation of the phase space geometry, which depends on the energy as a way to capture some residual effects of a quantum gravity theory.
Maybe first a more technical question, because you have this nice result that DSR derives from phase space curvature. But you use a special tetrad, and that seems to interestingly violate I guess it's a, you use a tetrad which with the Minkowski metric, no? The internal contraction for the tetrad is a Minkowski metric. And it seems that choosing the special tetrad violates rotation fully, the Lorentz symmetry in a sense. I think it was quite in the beginning you used a special tetrad, you defined a special tetrad, but the way you connected the metric to the tetrad was with the Minkowski metric, no?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
If you go to the, I think it was before the slide, where you introduce a, you had a special tetrad.
Okay. You mean
where E0 was this one? Yeah.
Okay.
And the slide before, you have the equation which connects the metric to the tetrad. No, and there you have the Minkowski metric, no?
Yes.
So one is one question might be why would you use the Minkowski metric here if everything is deformed? But also as a comment, you do violate then the symmetry of this Minkowski matrix by choosing the special tetrad. Because it's not anymore Lorentz invariant, basically.
Since we are considering maximally symmetric space, this metric is Lorentz invariant, non-linear Lorentz invariant in general, but has this symmetry. And regarding
usually if you introduce a tetrad,
yes,
you do introduce more symmetry because you can rotate the components of the tetrad. Would be basically the SO, that would be Lorentz symmetry. You know, it would be the Lorentz rotations in your case because you use the Minkowski matrix there.
But
then you choose a special tetrad which violates this Lorentz symmetry. Anyway, I wanted to understand, you know, it's if you deform Lorentz symmetry, why should you choose as internal matrix the Minkowski matrix?
Okay, the use of the tetrad is just a very useful tool in order to obtain the composition law when one wants an associative composition law. But for example, you can start directly from the Sitter metric, whatever you want, and you say, okay, I want that I define the Lorentz transformation. I obtain the Lorentz transformation imposing this equation, and then I say, okay, I want that this metric is also has a composition law, some isometries that are translations, and then K prime is P O plus Q, the composition. And then you don't need to talk about a tetra. Okay, there are different composition laws, but if you impose that the composition law is associative, you obtain one and only one composition law given a metric.
Okay, and a last question, which is more general, has less to do with your talk, which is that my understanding is that it has been quite difficult to formulate a quantum field theory on, you know, Kappa Poincaré, and so you kind of added G to that, and another way would be to try to add quantum field theory on Kappa Poincaré. Can you comment on that?
What are
the difficulties?
The main difficulty is that for example, there is a canonical non-commutativity in which the space-time coordinates commute and doesn't commute and have a tensor which are constant. And in this case, there is a star product, a Moyal structure, in the sense that you multiply plane waves, and it's relatively simple. I mean, there is a completely quantum field theory in this scheme, but when introducing Kappa Poincaré, I think that the main problem is the composition law, since in the case of the canonical non-commutativity, the composition law is the same because this is not modified. It is possible to do a quantum field theory, but in DSR is still an open question.
Thank you.
All right.
I have a question, Javier. Thanks for the talk. It was very comprehensive. You mentioned in the beginning, you mentioned the deformation of the composition law. So can you say a bit more when you go and you talk about your geometry on phase space? So you talked a lot about the geometry of momentum space associated with the dispersion relation. Is there a way to determine how that geometry of phase space affects the composition law? What's the
interplay? In fact, Okay, yeah. In the phase space, you have the base manifold and the fiber, and then you can define a modified composition law for a fixed space-time point, and then you are defining for a fixed space-time point the translations along the fiber.
Is there a relationship in the geometry, and the deformation of the composition law?
Yes, the difference is just okay. The composition law is P bar O plus Q bar, where P bar is P times the inverse of the detracting momentum space.
So it's a linear addition of P bar.
Yes, it's a simple relation. You define you can define translations as P O plus bar Q, where this O plus bar takes into account the curvature on momentum space. On space time.
Okay. And that's yes, because you're having essentially a linear structure by assuming that you have a T star of M as a geometry, right? You could go beyond that. That is, look at what's called generalized geometry, where also the, momentum space is not embedded. The fiber, if you want, is not a linear fiber. Have you looked into that?
What do you mean by that the momentum space is non-linear?
Where you can have phase space, which are not T star of M, right? So you can have phase space where some of the base, you can have a phase space which is fibrated over space time, but the fiber is not a plane, it's in the linear space. You have a fully curved manifold, if you want.
Yes. In the book I mentioned in the talk, this is the only way in which I know that one can construct a fixed space geometry. You consider that you have a metric in momentum in space time, and you have the phase space, the line phase space I showed before, in which there is the same metric with these delta k's. Mm-hmm. Derivatives, and this is the only way I know in which the phase space it can be constructed in a consistent way.
Okay, well, we could talk about other ways, like marginal ways. I had a question about the Einstein equations there. If your geometrical space is somehow now twice the dimension, here you're writing always equations which are at fixed momentum k and which are space-time, but ultimately, there's going to be an interplay between the geometry of space and the geometry of momentum space. So you would expect, other conditions, and somehow here, it shows up in your result that you get some kind of rigidity, that only the Sitter space appears as the possibility.
Yes, in fact, in this book, it was considered that you have three Riemann tensors, in the sense that you have one curvature tensor for the space-time, one for the fibers, and another one interplaying them, as you said. For the momentum one, we know that is also maximally symmetric, so you can have the same structure of a de Sitter or anti de Sitter or whatever maximally symmetric space you want. And in space-time, you have this one. Okay, in the intertwined plane, we didn't pay too much attention on it.
You mean the mixed one? What's happening with the mixed one? You don't know?
Yes, it's a complicated expression between which mixes the affine connection of space-time and momentum space. and some derivatives there, and also the is a complicated expression.
Okay.
But I don't know. I think that the physical point is the Einstein tensor constructed as a way to, I mean, in space-time.
Yeah, but let's say you go away from that limit G equals zero, H equals zero. You know, part of the idea, maybe not of DSR, but of relative locality, is that at some point, well, there is a backway. I mean, you know, there's an interplay between the geometry of space and the geometry of momentum space. So you can't, you know, this idea that it's completely splittable and space-time is an absolute quantity, it's really a classical idea, right? So when you say you just want the geometry of space-time, it's, you know, going back to your initial motivation, where your initial motivation that is what you want to have a generalized form of geometry because you want to be able to accommodate the fact that maybe space is not, you know, space is a foamy structure or space is something that fluctuates, right? And the idea is that momentum space therefore couples to space. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but I don't know. In this scheme, you have what you said, space-time, momentum space, and Arrhenius-Wiener, because you're considering a geometry for the whole phase space. Okay, I agree that in this expression, we are focusing on the space-time only, but this is a consequence of having a curvature in momentum space.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the question would be how would you try to, you know, include in that picture like quantum gravity like corrections or what's your idea about that? I mean, it's a geometrical setting, but somehow it should be supposed to be an approximation of a bigger theory. So is there a way you think it's possible to embedded, you know, look at corrections or fluctuations around that structure?
I don't know. The only thing that I can think now is if you can obtain the Einstein equations through an action, the Hilbert-Einstein action, maybe you can work on that and see what happens in this scheme with a momentum dependency of the metric or whatever. But I didn't think about this before.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we have other questions?
Lee doesn't have any question.
You want me to ask a question? If we start, so these are going to be very basic. And thanks very much for the talk. If we start with the idea that relative locality or doubly special relativity are about a limit of some fundamental theory of quantum gravity, as we take h bar to zero and g to zero, et cetera, holding the Planck marks fixed, how does that help us to find that quantum theory of gravity? In other words, have you thought? I mean, supposing that using geometry very cleverly, as people have done, you are able to say something about what that limit could be. The goal is to find the quantum theory of gravity. How do we use the very elegant things that we've learned in order to make a quantum theory of gravity?
That's not an elementary question.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's elementary in the sense it's strategic.
I don't know how to answer. I don't know, but I think that this geometrical approach has several improvements with respect to the understanding of, for example, we are working now in how to obtain the principle of the relative locality principle from this geometrical approach.
So can you say something about that?
This is something that is not published yet, and we are working on that. But basically, what we are doing is to consider that you have instead of considering a geometry for only one momentum, you can consider or one particle. You can consider the geometry of a multi-particle system in all, considering, for example, a many-particle system. And a geometry which is has four n dimensions within the number of particles you are considering.
Good.
And in this case, we obtain that the spacetime of the initial and final spacetime points of the interacting particles are not in the there is a non-locality, basically, which is the same locality one finds in the well-known paper of relative locality which is related to the vertex and the derivatives of the composition law.
Good. So are there any experimental implications for that? I mean, people do a lot of n-body physics. So is there any context in which that would be relevant?
Sorry, you said about the phenomenology.
Yes. Yes. If you have new effects with n-body physics, might they show up in neutron stars or white dwarfs or something like that?
Yes, we are playing, for example, accretion disks and orbit of photons in order to describe the black hole radius we measure and modifications on the Shapiro effect and echo time delay. And okay. Also, we are planning also to do something about the electromagnetic interaction, since we saw that the synchrotron radiation gives the stronger constraint in this scheme.
Good. Are you thinking about statistics at all?
Statistics?
Yes, if you're doing n-body physics, does modifying the geometry of momentum space, could it possibly be used or have an implication for the statistics of the particles?
This is something that we didn't think about.
Okay. It's very interesting what you've done, and you've taken these geometrical things very far. But I'm wondering about how we get back to physics. So that's the origin of my question.
I don't know. For example, there was a talk in the DSR meeting of yesterday about the muon lifetime. And
muon lifetime.
Yes.
Okay.
Of Christian Pfeiffer and Yerley Lobo, and they obtained a constraint, I think, that for the Lorentz violating case. And we could do, for example, the same for in this framework.
Okay, well, that could be interesting.
Also, I started to work with Christian Faber, and he said something about the to set a time delay, but base it on mirrors and to compute the proper time as the time that is measured by a clock and say if there is or not a time delay in this scenario. Also, if we obtain how to construct a multiparticle system in this geometrical approach, we can for example study the a time delay for we can construct a model for a time delay saying that emission and detection are depicted by some kind of interaction.
Mm-hmm. That would be a new interaction. Something that the theory forces on us. So,
I have a question.
Go on.
I have a question about cosmology. So, I would think that one of the most naive observation that one has to do in order to check this hypothesis would be an observation about the global sky maps, right, at different energy level. So clearly, if there's a momenta dependence which is not linear, you would expect that the locations of galaxies and sources, astronomical sources in the sky, are in fact not the same, you know, in the visible, in the infrared, and in the UV. So there's about a dozen or 15 sky maps there which are there. And so that's an old idea following from ESR, but it seems to me that that's a very specific. If you take your model, you would have a very specific prediction for what people should look at deviation on different sky maps, right? And that could be something interesting. So I don't know if you worked out that, but in some sense there would be a fundamental difference in what you see in the sky if you really take that geometry of minimal space seriously. Do you agree?
I was thinking that, for example, using the metric, okay, maybe not so simple, but using, for example, the metric I showed, this one,
mm-hmm.
In this case, for massless particles, you don't have a modification of the metric. And there is no modification of the equation of motions, and I don't know.
I'm not talking about the modification of the equation of motion. I'm talking about the old sky survey, like the W map, the infrared maps, right? They won't look the same. They are maps of the sky, the entire sky, 360 degrees, right? So this is a matter of the geometry of space-time at different energy,
mm-hmm.
right? In that case, you have a specific prediction for what that geometry now you're saying is momentum dependent. One of the basic assumption of space-time geometry is that it's not momentum dependent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm not talking about how one photon, you know, propagates. I'm talking about the correlation across the sky at different angles of all the photons coming from us from the, you know, the Big Bangs, the galaxies, the different layers of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a good point, yes. I agree.
Right. That's maybe one of those maybe most direct observational prediction that you would have. You would have a distortion of these maps depending on the level of the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge there is that if you talk to experimentalists, in fact, they assume that the galaxies are located in the same way in the sky at different frequencies. So that's how they map the sky. So they don't really measure the deviation. So you would have to have a very specific prediction for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
you haven't looked at how the how the maps looks, like, you know, the W map in the relationship with the infrared.
Mm-hmm.
So you, just a simple question again. You were at the same the DSR meeting that just ended. And what did you think? At the end, I was trying to get the old guys to shut up and hear what the younger people have to say about the future of the field. So can I ask you now? What do you think is the most promising direction? Was there anything new or surprising at the talk?
For me now is just as I commented that the high energy scale modifying the metric, the kinematics of special relativity doesn't have to be the Planck energy. These open apps, for example, we have some words trying to say what happens in accelerator physics in LHC and CASA constraint on the high energy scale of the order of TeV. For example, looking on the universe transparency, we obtain a similar constraint. Also here in the synchrotron radiation for the superluminal case, we obtain a constraint of some PV. I don't know, maybe this opens up a new phenomenology. Yeah, this is, I think that this is really interesting.
I agree. So what could that affect the early universe or the issue of the ionization or the reionization?
I don't know.
That sounds like something that could be really interesting. I agree with you. There's a lot of phenomenology around what happens inside of stars or neutron stars if there's some grand unified physics. And basically you're proposing new physics around the grand unification scale and not too far above it.
Mm-hmm.
That is really an interesting idea. So if this is not whatever, you thought the most exciting ideas at the conference were yours?
No, I mean,
Don't be, a lot of us go to conferences and feel that way. Sorry,
that's not. And there is some, also, for example, Giulio Govitosi talk today about the fact that for a multi-particle system, one needs to take into account all the particles of the that play a role in the interaction. And this means that you need to consider, you have to know all the history of the universe, and maybe a cluster decomposition in DSR could be interesting, as she said.
Yes, I agree. That was very interesting. The idea that the spectator problem, as apparently it's called, but seeing it as a feature, not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically my way of understanding that, which may not be perfect, is that it's really telling you what the message has been all along, which is that there is no single space time. And if you want to talk about the trajectory of a particle that's had many interactions, you have to kind of give each leg, say, imagine it's an electron that goes bouncing off of different charged particles. Each leg is in its own space-time.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, so let's thank Javi again.
Thank you, Javi.